Texas 24-hour weather center. I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 10 a.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service, GARS. Hello, I am Herbert Gilmore. This is Prevention Magazine. I'll be reading articles for February 2nd, 2021's episode of Prevention Magazine. The first article is How to See What You Cannot See by Merrill David Landau. Everyone, even the best intentioned among us, has unconscious biases deeply ingrained, sometimes subtle prejudices against people who are in marginalized groups or embody a trait with which we don't want to be associated. The key to shedding these preconceptions lies in understanding our own brains. If someone asks you whether people of different genders should be treated equally, or black people deserve the same opportunity as white people, odds are you'd say yes. Americans have had strides over the decades in law and in life, reducing overt prejudice against members of society's marginalized groups, even as the rise of white supremacist movements and the increased awareness of police violence against black people showed that we have light years to travel before we achieve full equality. Recently, white Americans seem to have entered a new stage of reckoning with anti-blackness. This is due to the work of black activists who have focused attention on police murders, as well as anti-black rhetoric and violence at Black Lives Matter protests. But the sad truth is that even among people who think themselves as having no prejudices, subtle and more insidious biases remain, in part because they fly under the radar of those who hold them, especially when they are members of a dominant group, white or heterosexual people, for example. These biases involve gender and race, but can also be related to religion, body weight, sexual orientation, physical ability, and many other traits. None of us like to think of ourselves as biased, but no one is immune. Even people who consider themselves incredibly egalitarian are subject to unconscious bias, says Calvin Lai, PhD, an assistant professor of psychological and brain sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. Perhaps when you hear a person on TV speaking with a southern accent, you're surprised to learn they're smart. Or if you pass someone with a larger body, you make assumptions about them because of their weight. If you've ever had a gut feeling that a person you've just met wouldn't quite fit your friend group or office culture, implicit bias might have been at work. Close your eyes for a moment and quickly picture a scientist. What came to mind? Do you envision an older white man, maybe with Albert Einstein-esque hair? Default assumptions like this about what kind of person should be a certain role are a form of bias, with very real effects. When researchers at Yale University sent professors otherwise identical resumes for a lab position, some with names traditionally associated with men and some with names traditionally associated with women, more of the professors, including those who were women, said they would hire the men, and they offered to pay them more, according to a study published in the journal PNSA. Implicit bias is, of course, especially widespread in the United States when it comes to race and gender. In a subsequent version of the resume study published in Sex Roles, the names of the candidates seemed to indicate that applicants were black, white, Latinx, or Asian. Black women and Latinx women and men were rated lowest in hireability compared with others. The professors reviewing their resumes ranked women of color as less competent than their white counterparts, and both groups were ranked below the men. Other research has uncovered that black guests on Airbnb are less likely to be approved to rent a property, that preschool-aged black children are suspended or expelled at up to four times the rate of white children, and that people assign a higher value to an object when a white person's hands hold it in it than when it's held by a black person's hand. For people on the receiving end of bias, the practical and psychological repercussions are vast, harmful and heartbreaking. Being unfairly rejected by a school can derail a career, and losing out on a job and ending up with a lower pay can lead to a myriad of disadvantages, including reduced access to quality health care. Health care providers have been shown to harbor biases against Black, Latinx, and Indigenous people, as well as other people of color, which can result in poor health outcomes. The fact that these unconscious biases don't involve what members of dominant groups customarily consider overt racism doesn't diminish the devastating effects. The brain is built for bias. Fortunately, with significant determination and effort, we can become aware of our biases and work to eliminate them. Short interventions don't yield long-lasting results, Sly says. Our attempts must be consistent and sustained. Self-monitoring is a part of it, but the bulk of the effort involves recognizing and working to change the culture of systemic racism and discrimination that instill those biases in the first place. See what to turn to. Why is this so challenging? Because in addition to living in a culture that reinforces our biases every single day, we are working against the way our minds naturally function. Human beings regularly take shortcuts in thinking. If we had to ponder everything carefully, from how to dress in the morning to how to perform a work task we've completed thousands of times, we collapse from mental exhaustion. We do such things without thinking. These mental shortcuts can lead to problematic biases because they're often based on discriminatory images or ideas we've seen or heard repeatedly. Implicit biases generally favor the socially dominant group in society, Lai says. And in the United States, that often means white people, specifically straight, white, relatively thin, Christian men. So strong is this idea of the norm in our society that members of marginalized groups can have biased thoughts about their peers with similar traits. For example, people in large bodies often think negatively about other large people, says Mary S. Himmelstein, Ph.D., an assistant professor of psychological sciences at Kent State University in Kent, Ohio. And marginalizations build one another. So while white women's ideas may often be ignored in a meeting full of men, a Black woman's are even more likely to be ignored, says Eva Pietre, Ph.D., an assistant professor of psychology at Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis. If that woman is also disabled or lesbian and or has a large body, she is in many settings exponentially more likely to be looked through or mistreated by her less marginalized peers. One way in which experts determine what unconscious biases we have is through a test developed at Harvard known as the Implicit Association Test, IAT, in which subjects are asked to associate images with words as quickly as possible. Concepts linked in memory get categorized faster, says Lai. You can group peanut butter with jelly in less time than linking peanut butter to pickle. These tests consistently find, for instance, a picture of a white person is joined with the word good faster than one of a Black person is joined with the same adjective, especially when the tester is white. You can take the IAT by searching for the Project Implicit online, but bear in mind that it is not necessarily a good measure of an individual's biases so much as of the biases we have in aggregate. Stubborn, but not cemented. Another way to lift the curtain on your hidden prejudices is to honestly examine all parts of your life. If, for no conscious reason, you have no friends of a different race, sexual orientation, or religion than yours, if your office hasn't hired an employee who is disabled, queer, or speaks English with an accent, or even if you're a teacher or a landlord and your favorite students or tenants are people like yourself, it's worth questioning whether implicit biases are at least partly to blame. Unfortunately, becoming aware of biases is not enough to dislodge them. Biased thoughts are sticky because they get reinforced by the world around us, which is fueled by the dominant culture. The conceptualizing of scientists as white men comes from the reality that in the course of history, most have been. Though that's starting to change, Pietri says. Himmelstein notes that fat phobia results from society's widespread, albeit mistaken, notion that body weight is under a person's complete control and that we all wish to be thin, so anyone who can't drop pounds must lack willpower. Actually, Many factors, including biology and environment, are involved in BMI. It's a biased measure of health. Stereotypical images and biased representations exist in advertising, TV shows, movies, song lyrics, what we hear friends and family members say and share on social media, and in many other realms. When societal changes do eventually take hold, however, they can affect our unconscious thoughts rather powerfully. Take sexual orientation. As recently as in 1994, nearly half of Americans said that people who were gay or lesbian shouldn't be accepted by society, a figure that plummeted to 21% in 2019. This change has been mirrored by a drop in implicit bias towards LGBTQ people in the past decade, and with more black actors being cast in roles beyond those of criminals and support staff, our perceptions about race continue to shift, says Lai, since media exposure to black people in positive roles, such as those of athletes and politicians, has been shown to reduce anti-black bias. Still, with limited positive imagery about age and disability, related prejudices have been harder to shake. Prejudice against people of above average weight has increased. How to beat your biases. The most effective way to overcome prejudices is expand your experiences so we're having meaningful interactions with people from diverse backgrounds. When we see people as individuals, the assumptions we have based on group associations fall away, says Lai. This does not mean relying on black or gay or large body friends to teach us. Rather, it's about stepping outside our bubbles, becoming more aware of our thoughts and teaching ourselves to challenge them. But even as we work on that, there are ways right now that we can avoid acting on harmful prejudices. Here's how. Disambiguate. Biases most often show up in ambiguous situations, such as when we first meet someone and don't know a lot about them. That's why in sex roles study, the applicants' qualifications were ambiguous. They had good, but not spectacular, credentials. If one had been a Nobel Prize winner, that person would have had a better chance of being hired, potentially overriding knee-jerk bias, says study co-author Asia Eaton, Ph.D., an associate professor of psychology at Florida International University in Miami. When we don't know a lot, people may implicitly look to stereotypes to guide their processing, Eaton says. To counter that tendency, do what you can to make ambiguous situations less so. Let's say you're looking to hire an accountant, a lawyer. Decide at the outset the exact criteria you'll use. Set a defined percentage for, say, relevant experience, another fixed amount for personality, etc. So you'll be more likely to stay objective, Eaton suggests. Avoid snap decisions. When overwhelmed or depleted, we don't think as critically, says Lai, and we fall back on stereotypes. Say you're a teacher deciding which two students you'll give a math award to. Do it in the morning when you're rested and less likely to resort to mental shortcuts. Push back against default assumptions. When you do notice reflex judgment pop into your head, challenge it and consciously replace it with a more thought-through opinion. As with toning a muscle, you'll need constant repetition for a lasting effect, Pietro says. Eventually, a new, more accurate vision will override the automatic one. There are many tools at our disposal to help us check ourselves, Life says. If enough of us deploy them regularly, society will be a much better place for everyone. Where to turn to learn? Experts agree that overcoming biases doesn't happen quickly. Fortunately, there are lots of info out there to help us start to unlearn our culture's most dangerous prejudices. Especially anti-blackness, Melinda Weeks Laidlaw Esquire is an organizational consultant and the founder and CEO of Beautiful Ventures, a company that works to normalize black humanity-affirming narratives in pop culture. We asked her to suggest a few things to read, watch, share, and ponder. 1. 5 Ways of Understanding Black Lives Matter, YouTube. This portion of the event Broadway for Black Lives Matter is an engaging 17-minute video on what the BL movement is truly about, presented by NYU professor, activist, and educator Frank Leon Roberts, Ph.D. 2. Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Black Racist Ideas in America by Ibram X. Kendi is an eye-opening history that chronicles how anti-black concepts were created to rationalize deeply entrenched discriminatory policies and inequities, and why they persist. 3. Racial Equity Tools Glossary. racialequitytools.org/glossary. Privilege microaggression. Model minority institutional racism. This site provides definitions and explanations for all the terms you'll want to and need to know to understand the conversation surrounding race in America. 4. Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates is a Stern National Book Award-winning message to the author's son. The memoir may leave you with a deeper understanding of what it is like to live in this country as a black person. 5. The Black Youth Project. BlackYouthProject.com. Want to know what young people are thinking? BYP is an online publication that amplifies the voices, ideas, and perspectives of black people ages 18 to 30 to empower and mobilize their generation toward activism and social justice leadership. That article was How to See What You Cannot See by Merrill Davids Landau. The next article is Sex and Love, Beyond Intercourse by Rachel Czar, LMFT-CST. We often use the word sex and intercourse interchangeably, but sex is an umbrella term that includes much more than penetration. A distinction many heterosexual couples don't consider until there's an issue with sexual functioning that prevents intercourse. That's when I see them in my office. Maybe the diagnosis is vaginismus, tight muscles in the vaginal walls, or dyspareunia, painful sex with menopause, or difficulty maintaining an erection. When intercourse isn't an option, it can feel like a devastating loss. But what these couples often find as they're working to fix the medical issue is that a whole world of sexual options opens up that may feel even better than what they started with. Reality check. Even for heterosexual couples without physical issues, their reason penis and vagina intercourse may not be the best destination. For instance, you may be having a painful UTI, a heavy period, or a stressful day. Or, this one's important, you may just not want to do it. The truth is that only about 25% of women report being able to climax through vaginal penetration alone. One more time for people in the back. Intercourse is not the sexual be-all and end-all for most women. It simply does not provide enough clitoral stimulation, which is a necessary piece for the pleasure puzzle for many vulvas. Then why is sex often considered an all-or-nothing game? So many of us are stuck in an archaic script based on heterosexual norms and a male-centered model of sexual pleasure. For couples in which sex doesn't involve one penis and one vagina, breaking free from this narrative has paid off. For example, women who have sex with other women are 20% more likely to report having orgasms than those who have sex with men. It's not their anatomy that's different, it's what they're doing. Broaden your thinking. If penetrative intercourse is not an option, or if you're just looking to spice things up by breaking free of an outdated script, I suggest that you first eliminate the term foreplay. That word indicates that there's a main event and everything that comes before it matters less. If this is how you're thinking about it, you're at risk of rushing through and missing the good stuff. Foreplay is sex. Let's talk about outer course, which is exactly what it sounds like. Sex that stays outside of your orifices. It means touching, rubbing, massaging, licking, or playing with toys. It means making out, dry humping, cuddling. Outer course removes some of the pressure. A soft penis can feel plenty of delicious sensations. Many men can have orgasms without erections, and a vagina does not need to be lubricated for the vulva, the visible part of the female genitalia, to find pleasure and orgasm. Also keep in mind that countless other body parts, nipples, neck, inner thighs, and more, are packed with nerve endings and ready to be explored. The traditional narrative that goes intercourse, orgasm, we're done, can lead to a pressure to perform sex that is unsatisfying overall, and let's be honest, the faking orgasms. Breaking free means increasing your communication game. Ask for what feels good to your unique body and give yourself the freedom to continue updating your sexual scripts throughout your lifetime. That article was Sex and Love, Beyond Intercourse, by Rachel Zarr, LMFT-CST. The next article is My Diagnosis, Why Did My Jaw Hurt For So Long, by Alyssa Rustic. My first symptom, a swollen, achy neck, could have been anything. But spring bloomed into summer, stranger things cropped up. A recurrent pinching sensation in my ears, sharp pains all around my face, and far worse than a tension headache, it felt as if a power drill was chiseling away at my temples. After a useless telehealth call with a general physician, I tracked down an ear, nose, and throat specialist, ENT, for another virtual appointment. She told me it might be a problem with my temporal mandibular joint, TMJ. We each have two of them, and they connect the lower jaw to the skull, allowing the mouth to move. I never had issues with my jaw, so I was skeptical. But the very next day, the pain struck hard again. It felt as if a rubber band had been tied around my jaw and was going to snap at any minute. I could barely brush my teeth. Even chewing solid food was a struggle. Soon I was subsisting on soups and smoothies, and this went on for a couple of months. Between that and my skyrocketing anxiety, I'd realized that my overall health was suffering, and I lost 15 pounds, which made me feel extremely weak. I found a dentist who agreed to see me in person, even during the pandemic, and I left with a pricey mouth guard and a prescription for 1,800 milligrams of ibuprofen a day. He told me to de-stress by taking a walk outside or reading a book, not helping. As another month passed, my pain grew worse. The tipping point. One day I yawned without thinking about it and heard an unsettling crack. The pain rushed back and I was terrified that I caused serious damage. Determined to find an empathetic medical professional, I did some digging and landed in the office of Nohan Bhaktari, DDS, a board-certified TMJ and oral facial pain specialist in New York City. Bhaktari spent more than an hour examining every aspect of my jaw, observing the way my mouth opened, closed, pinpointing pain spots along the way. He explained that the TMD, temporomandibular disorder, is an umbrella term for problems in the muscle joints and ligaments that involve functional jaw motions such as chewing and yawning. Yes, my TMJ was acting up, but it wasn't a simple case that ibuprofen could fix. He used an anatomical skull to show me what was happening. The thin piece of cartilage that sat between the head of my jawbone and my skull was slipping out of place. Because of that, I had a closed lock, meaning my jaw couldn't open with a full range of motion. That was likely aggravated by my unconsciously clenching my teeth during periods of stress and while sleeping. That triggered spasms in my facial muscles, which is why I felt so much pain and my headaches had worsened. And while these are not common, TMD can cause stuffiness, pain, ringing, and popping in the ears. The diagnosis. Bhaktari diagnosed me with muscle and joint pain, as well as an articular disc disorder of my right TMJ. He prescribed an orthotic, a specialized mouth guard, muscle relaxers to ease the spasms in my face, neck, and back, and 12 weeks of physical therapy. During my first physical therapy consultation, I cried because I finally felt like I had support from experts who took my struggles seriously. You may feel pain again, but the goal is to make sure it never happens like the first flare, said Amy Delvecchio, DPT, OCS, my physical therapist at Pivotal Physical Therapy in New York City. And next time you'll be more prepared to manage it. 10 months after my jaw first locked up, I'm out of physical therapy and nearly pain-free. I can now carefully eat a bagel, floss my teeth, wake up without headaches, and laugh without worry. There's lingering tension in my jaw and back, and my ears crackle occasionally, but my face is finally starting to feel like my own again. That was My Diagnosis, Why Did My Jaw Hurt For So Long, by Alyssa Rustic. The next article is Meet Your Eyes, by Adele Jackson Gibson. Focus, people, focus. Eye health is about more than 20/20 vision. 1. Built-in cameras. Your brain and your eyes work together to take continual snapshots of the world. The process works like this. Light passes through the colorless outer layer of your eye, the cornea, which directs it into the pupil at the center of the colorful iris. Another lens then projects the light onto the retina at the back of the eye. The retina has cells, rods, and cones that translate the light into nerve signals that travel along the optic nerve to the brain so you can understand the colors and shapes you're seeing. Changes to any of these parts can make things blurry. If the eyeball grows too long, for instance, the light is focused in front of the retina, causing far-off objects to appear out of focus. There's nearsightedness. This is why glasses, contacts, and LASIK surgery are so handy. They help refocus the light where it needs to be. Unseen dangers. Even if you don't need glasses, see an eye doc regularly. Ophthalmologists can ID diseases like diabetes and macular degeneration, which damage the retina, and glaucoma, which injures the optic nerve. In the early stages of these conditions, you may not notice anything, but later you could experience sudden vision loss. Cataracts are more obvious and less scary. These appear at age 40, causing the lenses of the eye to become cloudy. Cataracts can be cleared up with corrective lenses or surgery. To avoid problems, add healthy habits to your eye exam routine. Eat produce rich in vitamins A, C, and E. Wear sunglasses to block damaging UV rays. And exercise and avoid smoking to maintain healthy blood pressure. Ask about your family history, too. Glaucoma tends to be hereditary and needs to be monitored. 3. Not a dry eye in the house. We normally blink about 15 times a minute to keep our eyes moist. When we do, the glands around the eyes release a mix of water, oil, and mucus, aka tears, to keep things lubricated. But when we stare at Zoom meetings on screen all day, that blink rate can slow to 5 times every 60 seconds. That's why our poor peepers get dry and red. It's not because they're tired from all the blue light. In fact, science says the small amount of blue light from screens is harmless to eye health. Because eye dryness and fatigue are more about not blinking enough, try the 20-20-20 rule. Every 20 minutes, take a break from your computer and look at something 20 feet away for 20 seconds. Doing this will keep your eyes lubed up. Artificial tears can also help in a pinch. That article was Meet Your Eyes by Adele Jackson Gibson. That concludes today's reading for February 2nd, 2021's episode of Prevention Magazine. This has been Herbert Gilmore for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening to GARS.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 19 and mostly cloudy. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 30s. Then tomorrow clear with a high in the low 30s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the upper teens. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
This program is made available to the IAAIS Program Share and was recorded at the Audio Reading Service of the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Welcome, this is Able Living, and I'm your reader, Kevin, with the Audio Reading Service at the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from Disability Scoop, and now I'll begin with Group Homes Elbow to Side as COVID-19 Doses Shifted to Mass Vaccination Sites. This article from the Times Union, written by Brendan Lyons. It is datelined Albany, New York. Thousands of individuals with disabilities who live in group home settings have seen their rate of vaccinations for coronavirus dwindle as the state has shifted doses to mass vaccination sites and expanded the number of individuals eligible for shots. Roughly 30% of the Capital Region's group home population, about 11,000 individuals with disabilities and staff, members who care for them in a 10-county region have been vaccinated through the first 5 weeks of the rollout. But when the state shifted to mass vaccination sites, including one at the University of Albany, those locations were given, in some cases, 50% or more of a region's doses. That strategy has affected those who were in the first or 1A phase of vaccinations because a shift was made. In conjunction with adding a second phase of eligible individuals and included anyone 65 or older, as well as teachers, police officers, grocery and convenience store workers, and other essential workers. In a letter to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo in mid-January, three leaders of the groups representing the interests of individuals with disabilities, New York Alliance for Inclusion and Innovation, New York State Industries for the Disabled, and the ARC New York, alerted the administration that their very vulnerable population was being pushed aside as hospital hub systems, initially established to vaccinate the 1A groups, were receiving little or no vaccine. With the opening of the state vaccination sites and the reallocation of vaccine to these sites, this has reduced vaccine supply and availability for the 1A population to the point that appointments have been canceled the latter half of this past week and through the weekend, the group's letter states. Not only is this unintended consequences of concern for those in the priority population who have not yet received the vaccine, but it will likely result in the 1A designated people having significant difficulty attaining the second vaccine doses in a timely manner. On January 15th, the Centers for Disability Services in Albany canceled a vaccination clinic that had been scheduled for 170 individuals with disabilities and their caretakers. In recent days, Cuomo has urged county health departments, hospitals, pharmacies, and other vaccine administrators not to schedule any appointments until they receive their allotted doses for the week. That shift came as he blamed the federal government for not sending enough doses to New York, where vaccination appointments are backlogged and stretching into the late spring due to low supplies. We were grateful people with developmental disabilities and group home staff were included in the 1A, but now they've been elbowed aside, said Michael Cerreter, president and CEO of the New York Alliance for Inclusion and Innovation, which represents nonprofits that support people with developmental disabilities across the state. It's an unintended but serious consequence that's preventing high-risk and vulnerable New Yorkers from getting vaccinated. Group homes for the people with disabilities have been ravaged by the virus during the pandemic. Cuomo included them in the first phase because it can also be challenging for staff to control and direct members of that population who may not understand social distancing and the need to wear a mask. A person briefed on the matter said that using the hospital hub system to vaccinate that population, including distributing vaccines to medical staff in their settings, was ideal because many of those individuals have access to public transportation but were not able to drive themselves to a mass vaccination site, such as the one at the University of Albany. The hub system, which was highly criticized by county leaders who wanted their local health departments to vaccinate their population, including the elderly and people with disabilities, received praise from disability advocates. It provided health equity for people who would not always get health equity, the person said. We prioritized this group from the very beginning, said Gareth Rhodes, a deputy superintendent of the Department of Financial Services, who is helping lead the vaccination rollout for the governor's coronavirus task force. It's not like we stopped prioritizing them. They are still prioritized. We just don't have enough vaccine to go around. Our next article, teams to examine self-driving cars for individuals with special needs. This one written by Ed Blazina of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Stateline to Pittsburgh. John Tagg, chairman of the Pennsylvania Transportation Alliance, uses a wheelchair and understands the daily mobility challenges faced by people with disabilities. That's why Tagg is excited that a team from Carnegie Mellon University has received a grant to develop a prototype system for autonomous vehicles that will allow anyone to control most vehicle functions, from summoning the vehicle to their location to controlling the windows and the temperature of the air conditioning from their cell phones. The team, based in CMU's Human-Computer Interaction Institute, was among 10 across the country that received $300,000 in grants this month from the U.S. Department of Transportation to continue developing their ideas to make autonomous vehicles more practical for people with disabilities. The grant is part of the DOT's Inclusive Design Challenge, a competitive program to improve mobility for people with disabilities. Three finalists will split $2 million to produce their product. Nick Martellaro and Patrick Carrington, assistant professors at CMU, said their first step was to assemble a team of advocates for people with disabilities to determine what would help them use autonomous vehicles. Tagg and others told them that many people with disabilities can use mobile phones with a regular keyboard, touchscreen, voice commands, or braille keyboard, and linking them with autonomous vehicles would be a great benefit. We had ideas that we thought might be good, but we really relied on communications with the community to find out what they need, Carrington said. We really let that guide us. Montalero said quickly became clear that the mobile phone is the community gateway for people with disabilities. The group and designers believe it would be a great benefit if all autonomous vehicles have a common system for communicating with mobile devices. The phone is already something people have and use, Martellaro said. How do you leverage that to control an autonomous vehicle? We hope to develop a standard system for all manufacturers. Student researchers will begin working on the prototype when they return to classes February 1, said Sarah Fox, another assistant professor on the development team. The project will be submitted for another round of judging in March 2020. TEG said it's a real benefit for people with disabilities to be involved with a product from the development stage rather than trying to adapt something that already exists. A lot of times we don't get into the table until after something has been developed, he said. Here we have a chance to have that input at the beginning. Fully autonomous vehicles may be more than 10 years away, but TEG and the developers say a system that allows people with disabilities to operate them like air conditioning or communicate with other riders will be beneficial even before that happens. This grant is great for us, Montalero said. We get to do the work now. Our goal is to get the tested pattern to the point where the car companies say they can build off of that and produce a system every vehicle can use. Our next article, written by Sean Heasley of Disability Scoop, and it's entitled Mental Health Issues Affect 3 in 4 Kids with Autism. The vast majority of children with autism have at least one mental health condition, too, new research suggests. Almost 78% of kids on the spectrum are diagnosed with some type of mental health condition, and almost half have two or more. Even among preschool-aged children with autism, 44.8% have such conditions. By contrast, just 14.1% of young people without autism have mental health conditions. That's according to a study published recently in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry. The findings are based on interviews with a little over 42,000 caregivers of children ages 3 to 17 years across the country that were done as a part of the 2016 National Survey of Children's Health. Researchers compared the prevalence of mental health conditions in those with autism, intellectual disabilities, and other chronic conditions. Children with autism are far more likely than any of the other groups to struggle with mental health. There is something specific about autism that is increasing the mental health burden, and it's true not only for anxiety but also for depression, behavior problems, and attention problems, said Connor Kearns, an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of British Columbia and the lead author of the study. This is a special population that requires special attention. Among those with autism, parents reported that 60% had a behavior or conduct problem. Almost half had attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Nearly 40% had anxiety, and over 15% had depression, the study found. If we think about ways to screen and intervene against these mental health conditions before these children even get to school, then we might be way ahead of the game, Kern said. The longer mental health conditions are allowed to exist and worsen, the harder they're going to be to treat. It's much better to catch them early. Right now, we don't have a great system for doing that. The next article, written by Craig Wepp of the Akron Beacon Journal, and it's entitled, On Zoom, Comedy Offers a Way to Teach Life Skills to Those with Down Syndrome. Datelined out of Akron, the pandemic has not stopped the laughs and the life lessons. The Northeast Ohio-based Stand Up for Downs group has turned to the internet, and more specifically Zoom, to continue its work of utilizing comedy to help build confidence and life skills for the Down syndrome community. The group, founded by Canton native Rob Snow, has been around for a number of years and started up after his own son Henry was born with Down syndrome. It all began with a very personal talk to groups and conventions, drawing from the family's experiences mixed with some humor, honed from a stint with Chicago's famed Second City Improv group. These speaking gigs grew into a series of comedy shows to raise awareness and funds for the Akron area Down syndrome community. Snow, who lives in Medina, started offering improv classes locally for those with Down syndrome. This continued to grow with classes springing up across the country. When the pandemic hit, Snow said he wasn't exactly sure how they would continue on, but the organization found an even bigger audience on Zoom. So now there are dozens of classes with participants from all 50 states in Canada. You can learn more about the program by visiting https://www.standupfordowns.org/the-improvineer-method. It's growing like crazy, Snow said. That is something that has really flourished. It has grown to some 40 online classes a week with about 500 participants. And he explains that this is more than simply learning how to tell knock-knock jokes. By using humor and more specifically improv exercises, Snow said it frees those in the classes to simply be themselves and learn some life skills along the way. Those in classes learn to be more comfortable around others and be willing to make eye contact and hopefully land a well-paying job. They also learn to laugh and make others chuckle, too. As a part of this online expansion, the group is turning to YouTube to help promote the brand with a new show, Yes and a Guest, that features Snow along with instructor Jenna Swan, a Kent State graduate, lead trainer Maggie Bisesi, who lives in Lakewood, and program graduates Audrey Costolau of Amherst and Nick Doyle of Canton. The second episode was just posted recently and features comedian Colin Mockrey of Whose Line Is It Anyway fame. The five-minute show features a few interview questions with the comedian, then a series of improv exercises where they try to one-up another with humorous results. It was a real treat, Snow said. The students like Audrey and Nick could perform alongside a seasoned pro like Mockrey. They held up their own for sure, he said. They were super excited. The next article comes from Careers and the Disabled magazine, and it's in their section called Insurance, Financial Services, and Banking. And the article starts, Banking on Finance. The insurance, financial services, and banking industry stays steady, offering plenty of good employment opportunities for professionals with disabilities. Consensus is, according to many engaged in the insurance, financial services, and banking industry, that the employment future in this arena is bright. U.S. Department of Labor Statistics, or BLS, indicates a growth of 7% through the year 2028. One reason is a rise in life expectancy that creates a greater demand for financial planning services. That is why the finance, insurance, and banking has you covered in why you can bank on a steady flow of opportunities at all levels of major companies in the industry, especially during these uncertain times of the global coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic has brought to bear. The following employees of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, Franklin Templeton, State Farm, and KeyBank agree. They also agree that this is true for qualified persons with disabilities and offer advice for leveraging your assets and strengths for success in this sector. The first section here in this major article is about Sinachi and Daily Torres championing disability inclusion at J.P. Morgan Chase. Jim Sinachi and Beth Daly Torres have two vastly dissimilar disabilities but share deeply similar goals, ethics, purpose, and involvement in driving the employment experience for people with disabilities for the New York headquartered J.P. Morgan Chase and Company. An explanation, Beth Daly Torres, who has ADHD, anxiety, and depression, is a program manager in the Global Office of Disability Inclusion at J.P. Morgan Chase. Jim Sinachi, who is a C5, C6 quadriplegic, is the head of the Global Office of Disability Inclusion at J.P. Morgan Chase & Company. Our firm strives to provide legal opportunities for all employees and looks for systemic issues and policies that may not have been top of mind to remediate while driving awareness. Sinachi is head of the Global Office of Disability Inclusion. Daly Torres is a program in that office. They represent two-thirds of a small but mighty team. Dina Grillo, program manager, rounds out the staff. Together, they focus on recruiting. They work with external community organizations as well as Matrix team members worldwide, from global real estate, technology, and communications to legal, compliance, and HR, to set the strategy for driving an inclusive culture and set the strategy for recruiting, hiring, and promoting qualified employees with disabilities. For Sinachi, his disability as a C5, C6 quadriplegic is obvious. Not so for Daly Torres, whose diagnosed ADHD, anxiety, and depression doesn't manifest itself as noticeably, but both, however, bring to the workplace and beyond a caring, compassionate, and understanding approach. Urged out of retirement after a 39-year high-profile career, Sinachi acknowledges there was a time after his injury nearly 40 years ago when he thought his life was over. Instead, in many ways, it restarted when my then-employer IBM encouraged me to return to work. I did, and never in my wildest dreams did I ever think that one day I'd be leading a disability inclusion function for a company like J.P. Morgan Chase. He states, recalling with a smile, that it took nearly 20 interviews to accomplish that task. Sunoshi also recalls as well the wise words of his wife, Maggie, who he says told him at the time, by going back to work, you can help so many others. And during his 4 years at J.P. Morgan Chase, given his vast professional experience and undergraduate and graduate credentials, he did just that. Daily Torres, who holds bachelor's and master's degrees, often relies on her academic background as well as her own unique assessment of her disabilities to help others. My disabilities can be my greatest strength. I channel my anxiety into competitiveness and motivation and view my ADHD as a means to see patterns and solutions that aren't always obvious to others, she explains. Sunoshi and Daily Torres pull from the best of their experiences, skill sets, and compassionate natures to focus on providing the best end-to-end experiences, whether a person has a physical or hidden disability, autism, or an intellectual and developmental disability. Our firm strives to provide equal opportunities for all employees and looks for systemic issues and policies that may not have been top of mind to remediate while driving awareness, says Sunoshi. J.P. Morgan Chase focused on creating a new workspace around disability inclusion, remarks Daily Torres, whose job often entails working with leaders and employees to drive an inclusive culture. Working with partners across the firm, we demonstrate how people with disabilities contribute to the company's bottom line through universal design principles, accommodations, technology, and changing attitudes. People with disabilities are capable of performing at the same level work as those without disabilities. Regarding employment in the financial sector, Sunoshi and Daily Torres agree the future is bright. If you're qualified and want to work in financial services, then now is the time. Employers are recognized the value people with disabilities bring to the table. Do your homework, be prepared, and be ready to explain how your disability gives you the ability to think differently and innovate, then recommend. The next section of the article is about Ham using her tech savvy to problem solve at State Farm. It was her disability and her passion for problem solving that led Tina Marie Ham to explore different ways of eliminating obstacles through technology. Ever since I was 10 months old, I've worn an below-elbow prosthetic arm, so I'm no stranger to challenges, remarks Ham, who also built her confidence by telling herself that everyone has a handicap, with some just easier to see than others. Tina Marie Ham, who's worn a below-elbow prosthetic since she was 10, is a technology analyst and product owner of a technical team focused on automating compliance solutions at State Farm. Although staying positive is not always easy, lots of determination and humor can make a difference. You have to be able to laugh at yourself and never give up, never say can't. Looking back 30 years when she was hired at Bloomington, Illinois-headquartered State Farm Insurance Companies, Ham recalls that she worried about being accepted. I needn't have, she shares. There was never a time during my first few weeks that people didn't stop to say hello and welcome me to the family, and it wasn't long before I knew what it meant to be a good neighbor, as the State Farm slogan suggests. Her aforementioned passion for problem-solving led Ham to the IT side of her profession. Overcoming challenges is what gives me a feeling of accomplishment and keeps me driven. Finding something you are good at and that you enjoy is super satisfying. I love that State Farm encourages mentoring and exploring opportunities along with offering educational programs and training for advancement, notes Ham, who is a technology analyst and product owner of a technical team focusing on automating compliance solutions. As a long-term employee, Ham sees the technology side of State Farm growing as it evolves. Because of this, there are many opportunities at the company and in the IT space that people may not realize exist, points out Ham, who began on the business side of the technology support agents and information before moving to the technical side. Overcoming challenges is what gives me a feeling of accomplishment and keeps me driven. Finding something you're good at and that you enjoy is super satisfying, says Ham. Today, she identifies concerns and overcomes challenges by gathering input from her team regarding ideas for solving business issues using innovative IT solutions to automate processes that were once manual. Stressing State Farm's willingness to accommodate individuals with disabilities, Ham mentions, takes many directions, including securing needed equipment, providing mentors, making participation available in the Advocacy for Disability and Education Employee Survey Group, that's the ADE and the ERG. State Farm is most definitely an employer committed to diversity and inclusion, adds Ham, where she shares from experience the good neighbor philosophy that resides in the State Farm workplace. The next and final section of the magazine today says, O'Boyle manages procurement at KeyBank. For 13 years of his 20-year career in banking and financial services, Michael O'Boyle has worked at Cleveland, Ohio-headquartered KeyBank. He is currently a senior vice president, procurement category manager at this 190-year-old financial institution, one of the nation's largest bank-based financial services companies. I was at a point in my career when I wanted something corporate and something where I could grow in advance, says O'Boyle, who holds a bachelor's degree in business and an MBA. My choice at KeyBank was definitely the right move. Over the next few years, both procurement and my career transformed and advanced. Today, O'Boyle manages a team of 12 procurement professionals across several financial areas, as well as maintains oversight of the company's procurement group and supplier-driven diversity efforts. Our team partners with the bank's business, keeps pressure on the cost curve, helps reinvest money efficiently, and effectively manages third-party risks. As a dad of an 11-year-old son who uses a manual wheelchair, he also has another essential job. Born with Crab disease, a degenerative disease of the central and peripheral nervous system, my son's life was spared by a bone marrow transplant and stem cell replacement therapy, relates Boyle. Despite losing his ability to walk, along with some fine motor skills in his hands, he's now flourishing to the best of his ability as he prepares to enter sixth grade. He's also the author of Dinosaurs Don't Whisper, a book about dinosaurs on display at his school's library. As America celebrates the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act this year, O'Boyle greets progress at pleasure but continues to believe more needs to be done to advance disability inclusion. As banks become more digital, more thought must be given to the accessibility of branch networks and their online and mobile presence. With 5% of the workforce identifying with a disability, KeyBank focuses considerable attention on maximizing this important consideration for clients and their employees. Last year, KeyBank partnered with the Precisionist Inc., its TPI, and as a result hired 8 individuals with autism for its loan services and anti-money laundering groups. The success of this program led to discussions for expanding it further and hiring more employees with neurodiverse conditions. Well, that is all the time we have for today. This has been Kevin with Able Living. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Center's Solutions Podcast, followed by the Noon Book Hour at 12.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Hello, this is Michael, reading another article from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, published Saturday, February 6th, 2021. Midland Unified Command Team opens second mass vaccination site, from staff reports. The Midland Unified Command Team will open a second mass vaccination site at Golf Course Road Church of Christ Family Center, 3500 West Golf Course Road, on February 15th. Administration for phases 1A and 1B individuals by appointment only will continue. The Midland County Horseshoe Backstage location, 2514 Arena Trail, also will remain open for second dose administration. If a person received his or her first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine at the Horseshoe Backstage location, he or she will return to that same location for a second dose at that person's scheduled appointment time. Those people who qualify as phases 1A, healthcare workers, or 1B, over 65 and or diagnosed with a chronic disease, can register to get on this list for this distribution and future allocations of the COVID-19 vaccine by visiting midlandhealth.org/vaccine and clicking on the Click to Register button. Detailed information defining the populations included in these phases is available on the above mentioned website. If a person has had COVID-19 and wants the vaccine, the CDC recommends he or she be fully recovered and 14 days past the quarantine period. Currently, the state of Texas has put an increased emphasis on vaccinating those 75 and over. If a person falls in this age category, it is highly encouraged that a person to get registered for the vaccine. Once on the waiting list, a person will be assigned an appointment time and date and receive an email, text message, and or phone call with the information needed. This communication will come from support@healthipass.com, phone number 855-897-1447 for text messages, or 221-1111 for phone calls. After a person has a confirmed date and time for a vaccine, he or she must make sure they complete all the forms online that are sent prior to arriving for the vaccine. People should take a valid picture ID with them to appointments, arrive on time, and wear a short sleeve or sleeveless shirt. If a jacket is needed, make sure it is easy to remove. When arriving to Golf Course Road Church of Christ, enter the parking lot from Tarleton Street and follow signage and volunteers to the west side parking lot. A map of the location is available at midlandhealth.org/vaccine. If unable to drive, Easy Rider will be using Midland Route Number 2 to drop off at that vaccine location. Bus routes are available at www.ez-rider.org/routes.html. For further questions, visit midlandhealth.org/vaccine.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Friday, February 5th, 2021. Mass effort continues next week. The mass vaccination effort at Ratliff Stadium is over for this week, as health officials report that more than 13,000 have been vaccinated in the joint local effort. The clinic will continue next week, starting on Wednesday, for those seeking the first of two Pfizer COVID-19 vaccinations. Health officials stressed not to go to Ratliff seeking a second shot, as those will be scheduled after February 14th at local urgent cares and not at Ratliff Stadium. It is still best to register online prior to getting in line at Ratliff, as it will cut wait time. Medical Center Hospital Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Abbott-Timmons said information on how those who have already received the first dose will get the second dose will be released Monday. She said the second shots will be at urgent cares and that no one will have to wait in a crowded area, and that all precautions will be taken to keep patients safe and adhere to social distancing. Odessa Regional Medical Center's Chief Medical Officer Rohit Saravanan explained that the Pfizer vaccine second dose is meant to be administered 17 to 21 days following the first dose. The Moderna second vaccine is meant to be administered 28 to 34 days after the first shot. Saravanan explained that guidance from the CDC details that a second dose can be administered up to 42 days after the first shot and still be effective. The Ratliff Clinic has only used Pfizer shots so far, and Timmons explained that due to the mass production by Pfizer, that it seems to be the most readily available. Saravanan also addressed when full immunity happens following the second dose, about a week to 2 weeks after the second dose, he said, adding that immunity is personal and that even after that occurs, that social distancing and masks are still needed to protect others who are not immune. MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin praised the volunteers at Ratliff. He said they have requested 5,000 more vaccines per week on top of the 3,900 they are currently getting. Tippin did say the weather could be a factor next week at Ratliff and urged Odessans to keep an eye on it and to follow MCH's social media as well as local media for updates. Here is next week's schedule. Wednesday, February 10th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Thursday, February 11th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Friday, February 12th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 21 and snowy. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 30s. Then tomorrow clear with a high in the low 30s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the upper teens. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 11 a.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Good evening, and welcome to Vanity Fair Magazine. I'm your host, Paul Droba. Thanks for joining us tonight. Tonight, we are reading our first story from the holiday issue of Vanity Fair. That is the combined December and January edition of the magazine. Vanity Fair publishes 10 magazines a year. They combine the December-January editions as the holiday issue, and the summer issue, which combines, I believe, the July-August editions. The cover